The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Making meaning of this moment is that transformation is happening right now in Chicago and every corner of the city because of his leadership. And that level of transformation either makes you a hero or it makes you a villain. It's not lukewarm. It's either hot or it's cold.
Hi, everybody. I'm Fran Spielman, back from a week of vacation celebrating my mother's 93rd birthday, which is magnificent. With us today is Stacy Davis Gates, Chicago Teachers Union President. Stacy, thanks for joining us and welcome back.
Hey, thank you. And happy birthday to Fran's mom. What a remarkable life so far.
Yeah, she's sharp as a tack. This week, you kicked off your drive for a new teacher's contract that goes way beyond the traditional pay raise and health care and working conditions demands of most contracts. What exactly are you seeking, and what's the cost, and where's the money going to come from?
What are we seeking? We're seeking to transform the Chicago Public Schools. Since 1995, our union and ostensibly the movement we belong to, we've been blocked from having any substantial say in the operation and the delivery of education with the Chicago Public Schools. And since we have our bargaining rights back, we fought hard in Springfield to get that. We are embarking on our first contract campaign with full bargaining rights since 1995. We believe the sky is the limit. So what you see represented in our contract proposals is an amalgam of the needs and the desires of educators, paraprofessionals, clinicians, tech coordinators from every zip code in the city.
More than anyone, you and your union and your members and its union partners, affiliated United Working Families, were responsible for getting Brandon Johnson elected mayor of Chicago. He is one of your own. He's a former middle school teacher turned paid CTU organizer. How does that change the dynamic of these negotiations? It's not like having Rahm Emanuel or Lori Lightfoot in the mayor's office that galvanized your movement. Who do you organize against now and create the energy?
That's a great question, Fran. I think against, like, so you said, who do you organize against? I think it's who do you organize for and with in this phase. So we are endeavoring to organize with families all over the city to give them what they need. There's been a lot of talk about the newcomers in our city. And the quote stress that it is putting on city and school services. I also think there's an opportunity. Many of our newcomers are settling in Black communities because that's where the affordability and, quite frankly, the vacancy exists because of the years of pushing Black people out of the city through the lack of affordability, the lack of neighborhood schools. And so what we are finding is that our school communities need dual language programs. We believe that we have an opportunity to offer dual language programs on the south and west sides in the way that it is done on the north side. So our students can graduate with a biliteracy seal, meaning that they graduate from high school fluent in a second language, which makes a lot of sense as we continue to become a global city. But beyond that, Fran, I think it is very important to understand that the Chicago Public Schools have never worked for every family in every zip code. And it's not going to work tomorrow. The work of our union, the work of our movement, and with respect to this particular contract, is to begin to create the capacity and the framework, the structure, the will and the resources to provide a better education. What does that mean? It means that every single one of our school communities deserve a fall, a winter, and a spring sports program. Right now, that doesn't exist. I said on Tuesday, we live in a city where Earth, Wind, and Fire and Chaka Khan graduated from the Chicago Public Schools, Kenwood and Crane, Curtis Mayfield, who grew up in Cabrini Green. We do not have a complete wall-to-wall music program in any of our schools, from choir to band or to orchestra. We are losing out on opportunities to capture the imagination and the commitment of our students by not having enough. Young people need to be in a position where they have outlets to practice, to perfect, and to perform. That, too, is how you create community.
Well, that all sounds wonderful and noble and terrific, but it has a price tag, though, Stacey, right? Where is the money going to come from to provide this wonderful environment, well-rounded environment that you seek here?
Well, Fran, you tell me, you know, whenever there is a huge project, let's think about the West Loop. The West Loop is one of the hippest neighborhoods in the entire country. And it has been undergirded with a lot of infrastructure, development, and assistance from government. And that's wonderful because it is a great neighborhood and it does attract people and people enjoy it. And we don't really ask why. However, we always ask why for the Chicago Public Schools. And we have to build a new muscle and figure out how we start asking more dimensional questions. The question is, how can we continue to not fund our schools and offer our students what they deserve? Look, we need a baseline. Children are going into school communities from one zip code to the other, getting very different experiences. What does a Chicago public school, an elementary school, deserve in a school schedule? Do they deserve world language? Do they deserve technology education? Do they deserve a library with a librarian? And if we say yes to those things, then we're asking a different question. We're asking, of course we need to invest in that. So how might we invest in that? Look, the price tag for penalty and punishment in this city, this county, in this country is exorbitant. The price tag for public education is equally exorbitant, and it provides a better outcome for this entire city, for this entire county, for this entire state. And we're going to have to do that. I actually don't know how you don't fund public education.
But how do you propose they do fund it? What ideas you bringing to the table that you want them, revenue ideas?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question to pose to a president of a union. That's a question that we pose to the governor of Illinois. We have a progressive governor of Illinois who has his sights set on higher office. Wouldn't it be a wonderful story to tell that he is fully funding the Chicago Public Schools after really a lifetime of Chicago Public Schools always being underfunded, that we have vibrant school communities like Beidler. Beidler Elementary is in Garfield Park. It was on the school closings list back in 2013. Beidler community, with the families that attend there, community group, the faculty, the staff, the administration, they banded together. They fought back. They saved their school from closure in 2013. In 2016, the Chicago Teachers Union bargained sustainable community schools, which would provide wraparound supports, extra resources, a partner with the community, an emphasis on family connection and engagement. And that school is doing exactly what it's supposed to do right now, even with all of the challenges that poverty brings, that, you know, the legacy of underfunding provides. That school is doing a yeoman's job and offering its students something more well-rounded than many students in the surrounding neighborhood don't even receive.
So you're saying, wouldn't it be a great story if this governor who aspires to become president of the United States could tell that story? How does he do that with all the other budget pressures that he at the state is facing?
Well, that's a question for the governor, Fran. That's not a question for me. I can tell you how educators are putting together a list of things that, number one, they need. We're dealing with a teacher shortage right now. We're dealing with a group of young people who don't want to become teachers because they understand, quite frankly, based on the experiences that they had as a student, that they will be a lower priority professional, that the workspace in which they would inhabit, that they both have to fight for all of the resources, deliver the instruction, and then withstand the pressures of ends not always meeting. And so those young people are choosing to do something else. And then those who are still in the school community are overly burdened with the lack of staffing. So if we are serious about public education, making it sustainable in the city of Chicago and beyond, then we will have that investment. Look, our members, the families that they serve, have done a yeoman's job putting together a vision for how the Chicago public schools can become sustainable. It is up to lawmakers in Springfield to bring that back home. We have transportation issues, especially with our special education students. That is unconscionable. Then on top of this transportation issues for our SPED students, we have them for Black students. Black students, because neighborhoods at schools have been closed, are typically bused out of their neighborhoods. And if there's no busing, how are they getting to school? We have very clear deficits in the resources that come to Chicago. And if the funding formula is fully funded, then those deficits become more marginal. And I think it's past time that that funding formula receive the money that it's due.
What exactly are you seeking by way of the salary and benefit and pension contribution and class size measures for your members? You talk about the teacher shortage. What do you need to do to bring that up so that there isn't a teacher shortage? What kind of salary demands are you seeking?
Well, teacher shortage is a both and. So let's talk a bit about the workplace. Right now, if you have a fully staffed school, it is a better environment in which to instruct. So we need more educators and more paraprofessionals in our school community. What does that mean? Right now, if you have individuals who are already committed to their school community, we would like to see the district invest in them. So we would like to see our paraprofessionals go through a teacher education program, that we nurture them through the teacher education program by making it financially possible, and that we keep them in the profession, but they move into being teachers. Grow Your Own is an organization that is doing that right now, but we need that capacity to grow substantially. Number two, this contract and the wage fight is going to rest heavily on our lowest wage workers. Our lowest wage workers are paraprofessionals. 90% of those women are both Black women and brown women. And those women need an opportunity to earn a wage that lifts them out of lower to almost poverty wages. So we're going to work very hard to increase the number of steps on their scale and the number of lanes on their scale to bring that wage up, because these are the women who both reside in the neighborhoods in which they work, are committed to the school community, and deserve an opportunity to have their wage reflect the work and the value that they have in that school community. I think another important feature of what we are intending to do is to retain the teachers that we have right now. And retention of those teachers are both with salary and with professional, with their professional expertise. So when you get into issues like academic freedom, right now our teachers are telling us that they want to be respected as the professionals in their school communities. They want more collaboration with each other. They want the administration to work with them to create curriculum and to create the learning opportunities that they will deliver to their school communities. And I think that we have a very educated workforce, and especially in places on the South Side and the West Side, we find that the Black women who have legacy in this district, meaning that they've been teaching in this district for over 20 years, they're not just teaching for 20 years. They also have multiple master's degrees. They also have, some of them have terminal degrees. And what ends up happening is that they're oftentimes pushed out of the profession because they, quote, cost too much. CPS's new budgeting framework, we're yet to understand its total impact. What we do know right now, though, is that student-based budgeting is gone, which means that those women will not be at the mercy of, you know, fluctuating budgets. So that's already a win with Mayor Johnson's administration.
Okay, but what is the pay raise demand?
Well, you know, right now we are experiencing an extraordinary amount of inflation. So we are asking for 9%.
9% a year?
Or listen to what I'm saying, Fran, or CPI. So we are doing a both and. We are also going to make the pay and the benefits commensurate to the level of education, the amount of time, and the expertise that our members bring into the school communities. And we are going to also be clear about the inflationary space in which we are all operating. I'm a family of five.
So wait a minute, you're seeking a 9% annual increase or CPI?
I'm a family of five. Okay, Fran, just a second and I'll get there. In today's Chicago, a family of five like mine, we go to McDonald's after practices as our day is ending. And right now we're spending almost $100 there, right? Our pay has not kept up with the prices at McDonald's or the prices at Wendy's. And so what we are aiming to do is keep teachers in the city of Chicago. As you know, the cost of Chicago is climbing. And if you want teachers in Chicago, if you want to live next door to a paraprofessional, they have to be able to afford it.
Okay, so 9% a year or CPI, whichever is lower? Is that what you're seeking? Let me understand this.
That you understand it.
Okay, and that's over how many years?
Well, we haven't gotten here yet. Listen, this is the opportunity of right now, Fran. Women who dominate this profession are in an awakening moment, meaning that women everywhere are understanding that if they don't raise their voices to define who they are as individuals, to define why they have to be respected as human beings, that they'll never get it. And so our profession, my membership, 80% female right now. And every time we go to the bargaining table, people tell us we're being greedy. I have members who have more education than an anesthesiologist. I have educators that have more education than probably some of your top billionaires in this country. And yet we have to make a case for why we need a raise. That's unconscionable and quite frankly unheard of and professions that are dominated by men. Our educators are just as well trained, just as well educated, and quite frankly, needed as much as a doctor or a lawyer. So why is it that teachers continue to get the short shrift while lawmakers lament the teacher shortage? These things are connected.
But where is the city supposed to get this money? The city of Chicago again, is facing enormous strain. And so are the schools, frankly, as the federal stimulus funds dry up. The schools have a deficit for next year of almost $400 million.
All of my members are Chicagoans. They live in this city. They pay taxes in this city. And in fact, when you go on many blocks in this city, you know that that's a block where a lot of teachers live. That's my block, to be perfectly honest with you. What does that mean? It means that we are contributing to this city in very dimensional ways, from the macro to the micro. We are partners in this city. Our educators have helped to expand democracy in this city. They hold our city down in the toughest of times and the greatest of times. Last night, we had a House of Delegates meeting where Dexter Reed's teacher addressed his colleagues. Last night, we had a House of Delegates meeting where Ariana Molina's teacher addressed our House of Delegates. These are people who are not just educating in the city. They're taking this roller coaster ride with this city and remain 10 toes down and committed to the best outcomes in this city. We get to be valued, and the city gets to demonstrate their commitment to us as well.
Are you coming to the table with any revenue ideas of your own?
Well, Fran, we've always had revenue ideas, and I'm sure you'll hear more about that.
Right, but you have in the past favored, for example, the transaction tax on financial transactions, which the governor has said flat out no to. You've had many, many ideas. What are you coming to the table with this time? I mean, the mayor just lost his Bring Chicago Home referendum.
Listen, all great questions, Fran. So on Tuesday, our members, along with the leadership of our union, we got on a trolley and we went around the city. We went to Jerry Reinsdorf's office over at the White Sox Park. We went down to BOMA. We went to the Governor Pritzker's office. We went to the Chicago Public Schools. We went to the Civic Committee and their subsidiary, Kids First. And we said, come to the table and engage with us on how we might create the Chicago Public Schools together that all of our children can attend in every single zip code. See, we're coming to the table differently this time because, quite frankly, Fran, it is different, right? We have a situation.
You have one of your own in the mayor's office.
Well, it's not just the mayor's office. It's not just the mayor's office. As you know, people vote in this city. And because people vote in this city, we want to talk to the people in this city. Our work is to organize Chicago to the schools Chicago students deserve. That's what's different about today than yesterday, or different about 2024 than 2019, is that we are going to go beyond just making the mayor responsible. We're going to make the city desire something that they already deserve. So we're going to be knocking on doors, talking to families that send their children to the Chicago Public Schools. We're going to ask our civic partners to come inside. Again, we said we want open bargaining. That is, quite frankly, the best benefit of a Mayor Johnson on the fifth floor, is that we get an opportunity to get people to come to the table and be transparent and to show their work. We talk a lot about budget, but we also don't talk about budgetary priorities, right? So what are the priorities in the budget and how are they aligned with the mayor's transition report? How are those budgetary priorities aligned with what is actually necessary in the classroom? And our members have put together a litany of proposals that provide priorities, that provide clarity on what's necessary to both keep the teacher shortage, to close the teacher shortage, to provide a world-class education, and to move our school district into sustainability.
You were supremely confident that under the leadership of Emma Tighe, formerly of United Working Families, with her quarterbacking, bring Chicago home in the field, that it was going to pass. Why do you think it didn't?
Well, I think that there are a lot of mean people who blame poor people for being poor. I think that the real estate lobby has done themselves a disservice by fighting against 20,000 of our students who need housing. And what you know about us, because you just read this offhand very well, in fact, is that we belong to a movement, a coalition of people who don't take no for an answer. Look, Rahm Emanuel tried it in 2013 when he closed 50 black schools, right? Lori Lightfoot tried it in 2019 when she said she was going to be a partner and then proceeded to walk away from all of her campaign promises. And still we are here. And so we intend this time to engage with stakeholders, ask this question: how might we, the plural pronoun, transform our, again, in the plural, and this one shows ownership of our public school system? I am confident that we can do that together. I am also confident that the real estate lobby understands that they didn't win. We just got to round two.
So what happens now with Chicago Home? What strategy would you suggest the mayor employ? Should he try again? What should he do? Or should he look elsewhere for revenue? What should he do
to
bring Chicago home?
That would be for the mayor to tell you.
But what do you think
we intend to do? I can tell you what we intend to do. I can tell you that the Chicago Teachers Union and our allies and coalition intend to first engage with BOMA and ask them to come to the table to have a how might we discussion. How might we get 20,000 of our unhoused students into affordable housing? How might
is
we
it
figure
dead?
Out
is
a
Chicago
way?
Is Bring Chicago Home dead? Is the real estate transaction tax dead? Or do you expect that you're going to reach some kind of a compromise with the real estate industry?
So let me say it just slightly differently from how you're asking it. We still have unhoused students in the Chicago public schools. At Nicholson Elementary School, there are about 200 unhoused students and a student body under 400. That's a substantial number. So our mission is undone. So that's why you see very clear housing proposals and our contract proposals around housing. It is very difficult to instruct, to encourage young people who do not have the stability of permanent housing. It's pretty much nearly impossible. That said, we are moving into the second phase of our fight to get them housing. And so, you know, as most of Chicago knows, we don't take no for an answer. So first, we are inviting the real estate lobby to convene with us and figure out how might we get these young people into safe housing that their families can afford, right? Stability. And we are going to figure that out. And if we can't figure it out there, then we go to round three. The issue, is the unhoused. They still exist. And through no fault of their own, our young people, you know, are being deprived of housing. And it is our responsibility as common good practitioners, as common good negotiators, to put their humanity on that negotiating table in good faith. Ask the real estate lobby to engage with us on this. They
didn't
win.
This was supposed to be
the
first step in the mayor's tax the rich agenda, and it's off to a very bad start.
I didn't know that the mayor had a tax the rich agenda.
Well, he proposed $800 million in taxes and fines and fees to make these people investments that he believes is key to reducing crime. The first tax out of the box has been defeated by the voters of Chicago. So where does he go from here?
Well, we're going to go to the negotiating table. And when you have the mayor on, he can tell you where he's going.
Okay. Well, the mayor is approaching his first year in office. He is facing an increasingly rambunctious city council, a lot of pushback. There's even a guy who's got a recall effort against him. What you said in the fall in a tape that surfaced that you were ashamed of putting your brother Brandon Johnson into this position. You were actually emotional when you said it. What did you mean by that? How do you feel he has done in his first year in office? What kind of opposition is he facing and why? What do you think?
First off, Fran, you came well prepared this morning. Where did you find that video? I am pretty emotional about it. You know, there's a T-shirt that's floating around. It says, "I am not my ancestors." And it's a T-shirt that's popular in the Black community, which basically says that we, this new generation of Black folks, are not our ancestors. And boy, is that T-shirt correct. I don't know how Black leadership has been able to thrive in this country under the type of systems of white supremacy and patriarchy that exists. And the fact that he is experiencing the dimensions of both leading a city as dynamic as Chicago, right? Because Chicago is very dynamic. The segregation in this city gives you different impacts from neighborhood to neighborhood. The investment or divestment from those neighborhoods give you, you know, tremendous variability too. So the job in itself is complex and it is challenging. Then juxtaposed to that, Black leadership in this country is not something that's easily understood through legacy media. Legacy media also has to get better in telling that story of what the experience of Black leadership looks like and sounds like, and how bias enters into the commentary, to the analysis of their leadership. And I think the third thing is that he also belongs to a progressive movement that is doing a very good job of winning people, voters, in fact, to its side. Now, that movement is being threatened by those who are, number one, wedded to status quo politics, where the rich get richer and everyone else gets nothing. I think that the progressive movement also threatens this idea that people, real people, can't participate in democracy. What our movement has done in Chicago is kind of turn everything upside down. So folks are scrambling for meaning. People are trying to make meaning of this moment. And the thing that I can tell you when I said very vulnerably and transparently is that making meaning of this moment is that transformation is happening right now in Chicago and every corner of the city because of his leadership. And that level of transformation either makes you a hero or it makes you a villain. It's not lukewarm. It's either hot or it's cold. And that is a very precarious position to live in. And while I was being vulnerable in that moment, I'm also very inspired too at the same time, because who chooses to say that we are actually going to define Chicago through its working families, through its Black families, through its Latinx families, through everyone who lives here, knowing the intensity of racial politics in this city, right? He's doing something that people have talked about doing, and he's actually doing it. Like, look at the scoreboard. Subminimum wage is over in this city, and that is something that helps residents on the south and west side of this city. You have paid time off. Now we are seeing more parents and families come to report card pickups because they can actually take days off, or employers are now understanding more of their responsibility, not just to their employee punching in and punching out, but the 360-degree life of their employees. You have mental health clinics that will be re-erected. You have treatment, not trauma, happening. You have parental leave at the Chicago public schools, not just for our members, but for every employee at the Chicago public schools. That is significant because of the number of women of childbearing age that actually work there. So candidate Johnson gave us a long list of things that he wanted to accomplish in his leadership. All of those things are a threat to status quo, because if they weren't, they would have already been done. He's accomplished those things, and the critique has been fast and furious. What I would hope for the next year is that we get more perspectives published in headlines and in ink, that we get an opportunity to understand the movement from which he comes, and that we also begin to come to terms with the level of white supremacy, the level of racism that encompasses how people are trying to make sense of this moment.
So what you're ashamed of is what? What part of this were you saying you were ashamed of in putting him in this position?
I'm ashamed of how some of us, and I want to say that very clearly, some of us haven't expanded the dimensional relationship we have to race, to class, to housing, and to public education in this city. Some of this stuff is just as antiquated as it was when Al Raby was protesting Willis Wagons. Some of this stuff is just as antiquated as it was when Harold Washington was running for his second term. Some of this is just as antiquated as it was when Dr. King was here in North Lawndale struggling to get fair and affordable housing for Black people.
Has he been treated unfairly, and by who?
I don't think he's being treated in a particular way for his leadership. I am saying that our popular imagination, the way in which we analyze, the way in which we approach and create perspective, has to be grounded in a more egalitarian perspective, and a more racially conscious perspective, and a more gender-based perspective as well. Like, look, we are in the 21st century of this country. People can communicate virtually in ways and keep business going. We saw that during the pandemic. And yet, most of the commentary on social media devolves into race and racism. What does that say about our analysis, how it's shaped, and how we are holding the complexity of this moment? It's not easy to just say, oh, he's getting a fair shake because he's a Black man. No, I'm not. If you leave with that, then we're back into an antiquated way of evaluating this. What I'm trying to say is that we got to get our weight up as a city, a county, a state, and as a country, to see both the mistakes of the past, the opportunities of the future, and our responsibility to get comfortable with being uncomfortable with the transformation that we are obviously experiencing.
What mistakes do you think he has made in the last year? You've talked about the wins. What are the things that you wish he hadn't done and should change?
See, as teachers, we're not trained to point out mistakes. In fact, red ink pens and markers.
Sure you are. You do have red ink pens. They're all over the place on my papers.
I'm telling you, when I was educated in the 90s as a teacher, that was one of the first things that Dr. Lee told me to not have was a red pen. So I tried to maintain that. And this is what I'll say. Our entire movement has to get comfortable with having an opportunity to win. For so long in this city, people who have needed have been told no. We are all undergoing a transformation of going from demanding a thing happens, fighting for a thing to happen, protesting, rallying, door knocking, to going into a legislative experience to make things happen. Those are different muscles. We use all of our strong muscles to get to this point. The muscles that we have to develop now, not just as a movement, not just as a mayor, but as an entire city, is number one, we got to get more inclusive. We got to figure out how to work past our differences. Number two, I think we have to be very clear about the legacy of segregation, the legacy of racism, the insidious nature of white supremacy. And then I think we also have to all become committed to the project of Chicago, where every single neighborhood understands that it's enough for them. Right now, people are having a difficult time with hearing that because they don't believe it. Why should they believe it? What evidence has Chicago given in a sustainable manner that every person in every zip code matters? The skepticism makes sense to me. The way in which people are challenged in this moment makes sense to me. Heck, even the racism makes sense to me if you're a history teacher and you understand the cycle of transformation and change in this country. You know, the illustration of this can be seen very clearly with Donald Trump and President Trump and Obama. President Obama puts on a suit that isn't black or navy or gray, and it becomes a headline. You got a whole former president who's running for president right now from a courtroom.
Before we let you go, though, why do you think that that the public opinion polls that have been done most recently showed Brandon Johnson's public approval rating in the 20s? Why do you think that is?
I think that my answer doesn't change, Fran. Everyone's learning to do something different. And as a teacher, I can tell you when we introduce new skills into the classroom, that's the toughest part of the day. Is introducing new skills, practicing new skills, and creating space where people can both achieve and fail and get back up or continue. We are practicing something new in Chicago that offers those who have not had an opportunity to call shots, those who have not had an opportunity to sit at tables of power, those people are being invited in. Because they have earned it. That feels different for those people who have been there for generations.
So
they don't understand what's happening.
A metamorphosis, a readjustment of its thinking, and it's not adjusted to it yet, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. This is transformation. Transformation is probably one of the hardest things to lead as a leader. Look at the Chicago Teachers Union. Before Karen Lewis's leadership, it wasn't powerful in the way in which it could help set political platforms, electoral platforms, but most importantly, in the way that it has showed people that they get to receive, earn, enjoy what they deserve. That transformation, even in our union, was rocky. It didn't always feel good. It always felt different. And the amount of work that it continues to take to sustain that type of transformation is not for the weak. And so what we are experiencing is some pushback for all of the work that it is actually going to take to make our city work for everyone.
Before we let you go, is a strike off the table in this administration with this mayor sitting in the office?
You know, Fran, we're a labor union. We're not a political party. I know people want to, you know, redefine the Chicago Teachers Union in all types of ways, but our very statement of purpose is that we are a labor union. And so what we are doing as a Chicago Teacher Union is creating a definition of union that, number one, invests in the common good through negotiating, through allyship, through coalition work, through organizing. And we're a labor union that understands the power of solidarity and the power of work stoppage.
So is a strike off the table or no?
Well, we don't get to a strike unless we get to an impasse. Right now,
right,
we are
right,
in the
but
phase
it can't
of
be
how
off the table. You seem to be saying it can't be off the table if you're a labor union.
Exactly. That's my point. Like, it's a part of the DNA of who we are as an entity, you know, the right to strike. And that is something that I wish for every worker in this country, every worker in this world, is that they belong to a labor organization that will take their entire life, the life of their neighbors, the lives of their families as well, to negotiating tables. Look, if our democracy in this moment is to be saved, it is only going to be saved through working people. Look at what's happening in the South right now. You have, once the UAW finishes organizing the South, they are going to have more labor density with auto workers in the South than they do in the state of Michigan. That is going to be a sea change for this country. All of the bad politics that are happening in our country right now that seek to destroy, exclude, and divide are coming from red state governors. And if working people understand the power of solidarity, the ways in which we struggle to get the things that we all need, then that type of divisive political platforming, that becomes like narrow, that becomes smaller. The power of the worker, it grows and it become and it encompasses the imagination of all workers. And I think that's very powerful.
Stacey Davis-Gates, thank you so much for joining us. Best of luck in your negotiations. You have some wonderful goals that are also very costly. I hope you, I wish you luck in finding the money for all of this. And we will see you all next week.
I appreciate you, Fran. Take care.